This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
I'm Beth Golay. Welcome to Marginalia, a look beyond the pages of a book. Our first episode features an interview with Hannah Rothschild, a Renaissance woman of sorts. She's a documentary filmmaker, a nonfiction author, and she's chairwoman for the National Gallery in London. I caught up with her recently to talk about her latest project, her first work of fiction. The novel features a piece by French painter Watteau after it is discovered in a London junk shop. Both Rothschild's book and the painting share the same name, The Improbability of Love. And although the book and the painting are both fictionalized, Rothschild didn't have to wander far from her life in the art world for source material. Here's our conversation. Your book, The Improbability of Love, is about a painting by Watteau. Now, the book is fiction, and you created a fictitious painting by a real painter. Had you considered other artists, or what made you decide to use him as your jumping-off point? Why Watteau?
Several reasons, really. Firstly, I love his paintings. Secondly, in a way, the time that he was painting, i.e., you know, at the end of the Ancien Régime in France, with all its strange kind of courtly life and customs and extravagance and extreme wealth and extreme manners, seemed to reflect the time that we were living in today. Lastly, I have to admit, it's because very little is known about him. So as a novelist, it's quite fun to have a painter about whom nothing is known, because you can then slightly embroider his life and, you know, let your imagination run riot.
I was discussing the book with a friend of mine who also read it, and he described it as a kitchen sink novel in the best kind of way. You include so much information about art, about aristocracy, about food, about the Holocaust, but it never becomes unwieldy, and there's a lot of information in here. How were you able to balance it all?
Well, thank you for the compliment, first and foremost. I'm delighted it didn't get unwieldy. I think my training as a documentary filmmaker has stood me in very good stead. When you're making documentaries or any kind of film, as you know, you've got to kind of balance the story with what you see and what you hear. And that's the first thing. And the second thing is that I hope I would be my own harshest critic. So I would read it. And if I got bored or I got confused by something I'd written, then I would rewrite it. So I was always kind of editing as we went through. But I think the last thing is that this is a world that I am riveted by and that I inhabit on a daily basis. So I'm quite used to all these different characters and ideas and bits of history and bits of happenstance coming in. So it felt like if you're going to make a novel based in the art world, you've got to kind of, you know, corral all sorts of disparate people together.
And you mentioned you live in this world, and the characters in this book are painted with a certain brush. In fact, there's this one quote where you said the Earl realized that he had become just another person who knew the price of everything and the value of nothing.
The wonderful thing about the art world is that you get extremes of types and extremes of wealth and extremes of knowledge. So, you know, at one end, you'll have a very, very dedicated curator who's devoted their entire life to the study of art, who's paid practically nothing. And at the other end, you know, you'll get a very, very wealthy sheikh or an oligarch who maybe has just come into the art world, who knows absolutely nothing, but, you know, is obviously incredibly wealthy. So I'm always trying to deal with broad spectrums of people. As far as being cynical, personally, I never got over the thrill of falling in love with paintings, and I still walk around art galleries all over the world and, you know, have my breath literally taken away by some incredible image. So again, there's a kind of conflict, I suppose, at the heart of it. At the one hand, I am still the young person who is, you know, knocked out by the beauty of these, you know, objects. On the other hand, of course, you know, having worked and lived in that world, I'm also see that there's an awful lot of people for whom art really just is a kind of, you know, has a monetary value and not much else.
What was it about this painting that made kings and queens and popes obsessed with it, yet Annie was very willing to walk away from it?
The price of a work of art is set by desire and really nothing more than that. So it's how much everyone wants to buy it, how much everyone wants to own it, and that's what drives its price up. You could have the most incredibly valuable and beautiful picture in the world, but actually if nobody, you know, was interested in it, nobody wanted to buy it, it would be effectively valueless. All it is a piece of canvas with some oil on it. So that's kind of, that in a way is at the heart of what my book's about. So this particular little picture has many unique qualities. Firstly, it was owned by some of the most illustrious and exciting people in history. So you've got kings and queens and despots and emperors and popes, and then you've got, you know, Voltaire, you know, you've got intellectuals, you've got great lovers. So lots of people buy works of art because they want to link their history quite literally to people in the past. So one of the great things this little picture has is a wonderful provenance, a wonderful history. The other thing it has is the ability to inspire great love in whoever sees it. So because its subject matter is so, in a way, universal, it reminds people of their great hope and their fears, if you like. So that was the second thing. So Annie, who buys the picture in a junk shop, she actually buys it as a present for her lover. And she buys it because it reminds her of an encounter they had together. She doesn't actually buy it because she desires it. She buys it really through his eyes, and there's a kind of token of love for him. And what happens to her is that by owning the picture, it takes her into a kind of world of skullduggery and dubious morality, which she doesn't want a part of. She is a very principled young woman. She is trying to escape from people who don't do the right thing. You know, she's just come out of a long relationship with a man who treated her badly. So she wants a purer life. Her great passion is cooking, and really that's all she's interested in. So when she realizes that this picture comes with a whole lot of baggage, she wants to walk away from it.
Now, you mentioned the cooking, and I think, you know, that it's when Jesse was helping her in the kitchen that she really started to finally fall for him. So for her, it was more about the food. And food plays such a huge role in this book. And I noticed, like, in the acknowledgments, you mentioned some of the museums and people who helped you with your research. But where did you learn about all of that food?
Well, I'm not a fantastically good cook, but I'm a very good eater. I spent far too much of my life probably eating. So I absolutely adore eating. And I have, had great good fortune to eat very, very nice things. So wherever I've been, I've tried to explore different types of food and different menus and different influences. And I got very interested in the whole area of banqueting and what people used to eat at that time. So I spent many, many happy hours actually in ancient cookbooks and ancient history books, trying to work out what people would have eaten at different times. And Annie's particular kind of cooking is that she likes to conjure up the past through food. So she likes to cook food for people, you know, which is based in a certain time or a country. So she might want to cook, you know, if you were kind of living in medieval England, I dread to think what she'd have to cook, probably some rotting old bit of sheep, I don't know, but whatever they ate in medieval England. But that's what she does. She believes that you can conjure up a past time and a piece of history through really immersing yourself in their culture. And, of course, food is a hugely important piece of culture.
And she was able to, that's how she was able to conjure up her own past, because her father died early and she didn't really know relatives, and isn't that how she was able to create her own past in her mind by imagining what she would make for
Indeed.
These
yeah yes, there's a, she cooks in her head. And when she grew up, her mother was an alcoholic and very absent, and she used to try, when she was left alone in the house, to cook these imaginary feasts for imaginary relatives. So she imagined that she had certain grandparents and certain aunts and uncles, and in her imagination, she sat them down at a table and cooked them incredible feasts, and she imagined conversations they had and arguments and how they made up. So it was a real fantasy world, and her great dream as a young woman was to bring her imaginative fantasy world into reality. So that, you know, she wanted to do this, what she could never do for her own family because she never knew them. She wanted to do for other people.
there's the part of the book, you know, which is about the Holocaust and the reclaimed art. Mm-hmm. Yet you were able to, you know, the book is somewhat light. You were able to, I felt like there was a humorous streak, especially with the narrator. And the book was narrated by the painting.
Mm-hmm.
What made you to decide to do that?
The idea of the talking painting, so the painting actually does tell you a bit about its history and about what it's seeing around it, you know, came very simply from being a young child, and my parents are artaholics, and there's nothing they like more than a museum. So as children, we were dragged around museums, not very willingly, I have to say at first. I grew to love the paintings later, but I used to wish the paintings could talk back to me. You know, they used to kind of hang there looking kind of rather beautiful and dusty. And I think if only you could tell me, you know, what's going on inside your composition and what you've witnessed. So eventually, many, many years later, I was able to make my picture talk. And so really, this is what it is. It's, in a way, this is the summation of my childhood imagination. Just as Annie gets to cook for real people, I'm afraid I get to, you know, get my painting finally to talk to you. So that was that. As far as the kind of Holocaust and the Nazi threat in the book goes, I mean, my family had many, many, many works of art stolen by the Nazis during the Second World War. And we were lucky enough to recover quite a lot of those pieces, not all of them by any means, but quite a lot of them. And it was a story and a quest that ran through my childhood and adolescence and indeed through my life, which was these lost masterpieces, and would they ever come back? And obviously we have many friends and relations who, you know, didn't get their works of art back and didn't get their lives back for that matter. So it's a subject which is very familiar to me. And I think that there is a humorous tone in the book, but I don't think that I take the kind of Nazi aspect of the book at all humorously. I think it's a very serious thing that happened, obviously, during the Second World War, and the loss of so many works of art I take very seriously, and people are still trying, as you know, to get their stuff back. But I do think in novels it's possible to have a serious strand and a humorous strand, and that's what I've tried to do in this one.
That was Hannah Rothschild speaking with me about her new novel, The Improbability of Love, which was published by Knopf. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover new episodes at kmuw.org or through iTunes. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our editor is Luann Stevens. Our engineer is John Cyphers, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.